From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this Memorial Day, we feature interviews about soldiers who have fought in Iraq. ABC White House correspondent Martha Raddatz tells us about one of the turning points in the war, April 4th, 2004, or Black Sunday, as it came to be known, when American soldiers who thought they were on a peacekeeping mission realized they were facing an insurgency. She reconstructed the battle in Sadr City in her book, The Long Road Home. Then we'll talk with Navy Doctor Commander Richard Jaddick, who was awarded the Bronze Medal with the V for Valor for his work during the Battle of Fallujah. Jaddick and his fellow Medical Corps men set up their emergency rooms in the middle of battle instead of safely behind front lines. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Black Sunday, as it came to be known, was the start of the battle in Sadr City, in which the 1st Cavalry faced Iraqi insurgents and had more casualties than any single day since Vietnam. My guest Martha Raddatz has written a book called The Long Road Home that reconstructs this battle, which began on April 4, 2004. Her book is based on interviews with the American soldiers who were ambushed by insurgents. She also interviewed their families back home about what it was like when they got news of the battle. Raddatz is the chief White House correspondent for ABC News and formerly served as ABC's senior national security correspondent. Before joining ABC, she was NPR's Pentagon correspondent. Raddatz has been to Iraq 13 times since the start of the war. Martha Raddatz, welcome to Fresh Air. Why is this battle considered a turning point in the war in Iraq?
I think it's the first time that the U.S. military realized there are people here who don't like us. There had been sporadic and very violent attacks, a few of them. There had been a few suicide car bombings before that, but never such a wholesale assault on the U.S. military, and particularly in an area where the U.S. military thought they liked us. This was Sadr City. This had been under the thumb of Saddam Hussein for so long that the military and civilians assumed that everyone would greet the military with open arms. It's a thing you've heard over and over again. But this city, this slum, personified that because they felt that they would believe that the U.S. military would come in there as saviors. And that day, it was clear they were not.
What did they face? What did the platoon face in Sadr City that made them realize this was an insurgency?
Well, it all started out very quietly. They'd been patrolling. It was a morning where they'd done sewage patrols, honey trucks, as they call them. The Iraqis would drive around and suck up sewage. There's more sewage, raw sewage, in the city than you can imagine. And they had been escorting these trucks, and they realized, first of all, that the truck drivers, the Iraqi truck drivers, were starting to get taunted by some of the people on the street for even being with the Americans, and they didn't think much of that. And then, really just very suddenly, they started being fired upon, and it grew in intensity, and there were RPGs flying, this platoon, 19 soldiers out there, and an Iraqi interpreter were under fire, pinned down. They were in 4 Humvees. 2 of those were completely disabled and burning, and the crowds grew. It wasn't just the Mahdi militia, Muqtada al-Sadr's army. It was civilians. There were women. There were children. It grew from hundreds to thousands of people on the street, and every rescue attempt, there were more and more people attacking those rescue squads.
The soldiers thought this was going to be a peacekeeping mission. They thought it was a kind of routine patrol. How were they unequipped for the insurgency that they faced?
They were equipped for a peacekeeping mission. The Army, the Pentagon, decided that it would be bad to bring in a whole lot of tanks, a whole lot of Bradleys, because then you look like an occupier. Those are very bad in such a dense urban environment. And if you open fire, you're bound to have what they always call collateral damage, which means you can kill a lot of innocent people. So when this platoon came under assault, when these men were out there, they were in unarmored Humvees, some of them just had canvas tops, and they were in open trucks. It's really extraordinary when I see these trucks. In fact, when I was just back there a couple of weeks ago, I saw one of them. They're called LMTVs, and they're basically supply trucks, carry troops around, but they are wide open. It is like a giant pickup truck. And these soldiers hopped into these trucks to try and rescue this platoon in this wide open truck.
So what were the Mahdi militias' tactics in fighting the American military during this battle in Sadr City?
I think the oldest tactics that these soldiers, and some of them were sitting in their vehicles thinking, oh no, I've read about this, I've seen this in the movies, this is horrible. The tactics were often to put children out in front. There was a point when these soldiers were in this alley. They'd been pinned down for about an hour. They'd taken refuge in this alley. And on either side of this alley, and it was about 10 feet wide, lots of small concrete houses, and they'd taken refuge in one of the houses with Humvees parked in the alley. On either end of that alley, They saw hundreds of Mahdi militia and civilians lining up, and they would line up in tiers. And at the very front, they had children. Behind them, they had old people. Behind them, they had teenagers. And behind them, they had the Mahdi militia. And the Mahdi militia were firing over the heads of the children as they approached further and further down the alley. And Lieutenant Shane Awero, who was the platoon leader, watched them. And he, in his mind, calculated at what point his men had to open fire no matter what. And because he felt they would be overrun. And he watched those children. He has children of his own. Most of the men looked at the children aghast, but at some point they just started firing. They had to, because the Mahdi militia was firing at them. And the descriptions of what happened in that alley and what was left in that alley are horrifying.
Tell us a little bit about what did happen.
There were, Lieutenant Awero told me, probably 100 bodies on either end of the alley, piled on one another. Piles of shoes, piles of clothing, a bloodbath in that alley. And Lieutenant Awero and some of the other soldiers just said, in their minds, it was kill or be killed at that point. Again, horrified that they had to shoot children. But at the same time, they knew those were the tactics that often the Mahdi militia or other insurgents had used over the years. There was another tactic that some of the insurgents had used. And, you know, Terry, I find myself in the same problem here, what to call the enemy in Iraq, since it's changed so many times, but we'll call them insurgents at this point. And they would put a gun out. They would put an AK-47 out on a string, and they would pull the gun back to themselves, grab the gun, run out into the alley and shoot at the soldiers. Or they would get children to stand out in the alley and point out where the soldiers were firing from. They call those kids peekers. And they started saying there's a peeker over there, because the little kids would run around the corner and point at the soldiers. They did not shoot those children because they were not armed. But they would, if the insurgent would come around the corner, the Mahdi militia would come around the corner and fire, then the child would usually run back.
So those AK-47s on a string, was that meant to be a decoy to, like, deflect attention to the wrong spot while real action was going to come from someplace else?
Actually, there was probably that, but it was also a way, if the shooter was killed, they'd still have the weapon, and that they could pull the weapon back.
Another tactic the Mahdi militia used, which isn't as horrifying in the sense that it didn't take advantage of children, it didn't abuse children for this, But they would haul objects into the intersections. And talk a little bit about this tactic.
Well, that was what was astonishing. And I've driven down these streets in Sadr City so many times, and there are usually these lively markets, and they're selling vegetables and fruits, they're selling hubcaps, they're selling almost anything you could possibly think that any human being could sell. You have to imagine this, too, because it's absolutely lined with sewage. And, I mean, you can smell the city from miles and miles away because of the raw sewage, but the markets are out there. The day of this battle, the day of this ambush, the entire town shoved everything into the road as an obstacle course. It was a flaming obstacle course within about 20 minutes after this platoon was pinned down. They had piles of hot dog stands and what looked like hot dog stands, big metal stands that we can identify from streets of big cities. They had kitchen sinks. At one point, they had a giant metal staircase blocking one of the routes. And basically what this did was block off any kind of rescue, because they would have these main routes on the streets blocked with all of this mess that they'd pull down from the markets.
How did this battle in Sadr City finally end?
The real battle there didn't end for 80 days, because at the same time that they pinned down this platoon, they took over, the Mahdi militia took over every police station in the city. So as soon as they were finished rescuing this platoon, and they lost 8 soldiers that night, and they had more than 70 wounded, as soon as they managed to get that platoon out of there, they had to go try to reoccupy the police stations, take that back from the Mahdi militia. But 80 straight days, They fought to get those police stations back, to get the city under control. They got it under control for about a month, and violence broke out once again, and they fought for another 60 days. And look where we are today in Sadr City. It is a long way from being solved.
What is it like now in Sadr City?
You can't go in. I was there 2 weeks ago, and it's the first time. I mean, think about this and how long we've been there, or how long ago this battle was. It was not safe for anybody to go in. The military wouldn't take us in, and it is such a political firestorm there right now, as you probably know, that the Maliki government has been accused of being in bed with Muqtada al-Sadr. He is now in the political arena, but he controls that town without question.
Al-Sadr controls the town?
Al-Sadr controls that town without question. The last time I went into Sadr City in August of last year, you could see Mahdi militia members along the street still toting AK-47s. We went in there very quickly and got out of there quickly. I went back to see the alley again, which is a place I like to see to sort of get a feel for what's going on in Iraq, is to return to that alley as often as possible. But this time there was no chance we could go in there.
My guest is Martha Raddatz, ABC's chief White House correspondent. Her book about the Battle of Sadr City is called The Long Road Home. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Martha Raddatz, White House correspondent for ABC News. She's been to Iraq 13 times since 2003. Her book, The Long Road Home, is about the battle in Sadr City that was a turning point in the war in Iraq. It was the first sign that there was a major insurgency against American troops. Did the families at home hear about the battle first through cable news or through calls from the military?
The families, there's something called a family readiness group. In the family readiness group, the brigade commander's wife, the battalion commander's wife, Leanne Valesky, and Connie Abrams both first started hearing about the battle from calls from Baghdad. They didn't know who had been killed, and it came as 2 dead, 4 dead. Get the care teams ready, who would go out and help take care of the families. But the notification comes from the knock on the door. The notification always comes from the knock on the door. People had probably started hearing a few things about a battle in Sadr City. I know Cindy Sheehan heard about the battle in Sadr City, and she immediately said, "Casey's dead." And her husband said, no, there are 160,000 troops over there. There's no way he's dead. And by the time the notification teams got to her, she was convinced that he wasn't. But when the knock on the door came, that's how they do it. They only do it before 10 p.m. and after 6 a.m. They won't do it in the middle of the night. And the reason they don't do that is they don't want military families to go to bed thinking they could get a knock on the door in the middle of the night, because they know no one would ever be able to sleep.
Colonel Abrams, who commanded the division's 1st Brigade in Sadr City, was the son of General Creighton Abrams, who was in Vietnam, and the Abrams tank is named after him. But although Colonel Abrams had been in the military for about 22 years, until Sadr City, you say he'd never heard a gun fired in battle. How has he changed? You know, this person of from an illustrious military background, how has he changed by actually being in battle?
Colonel Abrams, who I describe as his soldiers joke that he's a natural-born killer, given his family history, is the most straight-ahead, salute, sir, colonel you've ever met. Always the colonel. He's a wonderful, warm guy, but he is very military. I talked to Colonel Abrams in Sadr City. They were just about to go back home, and he was, you know, ramrod, straight posture in his uniform and practically saluting me. And I asked him a very simple question. I said, "Tell me what your year has been like." And The division, by the end of the year, had lost 168 soldiers, either in battle or through accidents. And Colonel Abrams started talking, you know, very clipped sentences, and then he said, "It's been hard on our families," and he could not continue. He burst into tears. And he was so upset by this that as soon as we finished, he was calling me saying, I can't believe I did that. I'm totally humiliated. You're not going to use that, are you? And I said, "Colonel Abrams, it is a lovely, lovely tribute to your family and to the military. And yes, I am going to use it. And I promise you it'll be used tastefully." And he later that evening emailed General Peter Corelli, who was the division commander who was in Baghdad. They're all in Baghdad still, and I am too. And General Corelli did one of those great things, which is he forwarded me this email, unbeknownst to Colonel Abrams, who we both told. And the email said, "General Corelli, I try to make the division proud, but today I let you all down. I was interviewed and got emotional when talking about our families. I'm sorry to let you down, sir." And General Corelli wrote back and said, "You would have let us down if you'd done anything else." So to me, to see how heartfelt and how much pain these soldiers have from this and their families, but that they go back and do it the next day. I mean, the next day, they were fighting for 80 straight days. And the 1st Cavalry Division is back in Iraq now.
Why did you use that scene of Colonel Abrams breaking down and talking about what his family had been through? Why did you use it after he asked you not to?
He never frankly said, "Don't use this, you can't use this." But I think he understood how powerful it was, too. I think it's good for Americans to see that our military has heart, has suffered in this battle, gets up every day and does it again. I mean, to me, when I see someone like Colonel Abrams and I see the pain, the depth of pain, it is remarkable to me that people don't understand or that none of us have paid enough attention to this conflict. I went through a period where I would tell people, "Please, please, just when you read the paper, read the names of the dead. Do that. It's the least you can do. None of us have paid any price for this war outside of those who have family members there or who have served. None of us. Yeah, people can put up a yellow ribbon, but you still go shopping every day, you still go out to dinner, you still mow your lawn, and you don't think about it. There is the greatest diversity in the military community and in their families. You can't imagine it. Their families, they're like us, but they have experiences unlike those we will ever have. And it is important for us to connect with them, to somehow know what they're going through and not just say, "Aren't they great?" as if they're our, you know, hometown football team and go on and do whatever we do.
As the White House correspondent for ABC News, what's it like for you to hear often pretty upbeat press briefings from the White House about how we're doing in Iraq and what the outcome is going to be, when you've been there and you've seen and heard really gruesome things? You can't even get into Sadr City right now. Is there often a real disconnect between the briefings that you get and what you see when you're in Iraq?
Oh, is there ever? And believe me, it can drive me crazy. And there have been a couple of times when I've just been back. And in fact, the president had a briefing just a couple of days after I got back from my last trip. And he knows I go. He asks me about the trips. He's pretty respectful of it. And he also knows I know what's going on there. And I think it is an advantage for me because they know I know. I feel like I can ask better questions at some of the briefings, but here's the problem. It doesn't mean you get better answers. And I think the press corps in general is getting far more aggressive about saying, "Wait a minute, that's not really what's happening. I mean, I remember the day that they came out and glowingly said they're going to start all these provincial reconstruction teams around the country, and they're going to double the size, and asking, well, wait a minute, they can't even staff the ones they've got. They're not working. You've got a few people, you've got some unqualified people, the military is filling all the bills because you can't get civilians from the State Department to go over there. How on earth are you going to double the size? And it was just sort of, we are. I mean, I know. I've been there. I've seen it. It is actually disturbing to me. When I first started covering the White House and I first started hearing this, I thought, this is difficult. This is really difficult because I know what's going on. Now, I've also listened for years and through years of Rumsfeld saying it was the media's fault and we're not reporting the good news. I mean, the truth is, we're there. We are covering that story because the U.S. military is still there after 4 years and because it is still not under control. I mean, I heard General Casey say in one of his last hearings, Americans would not be safe walking around 50% of that country. And that's very true. It might be more than that.
Martha Raddatz, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Martha Raddatz is the chief White House correspondent for ABC News and NPR's former Pentagon correspondent. Her book about the battle in Sadr City is called The Long Road Home. Our interview was recorded in March. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Histories of Herodotus, in stores and online at bn.com. And from Fox Searchlight, presenting Once, the tale of two kindred spirits making music and finding romance on the bustling streets of Dublin, now playing in select theaters. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, practicing combat medicine during the Battle of Fallujah, we talk with Navy doctor Commander Richard Jaddick. Instead of setting up medical aid stations safely behind front lines, he and his fellow corpsmen set up their emergency rooms in the middle of the battle in order to get to the wounded quickly. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In November 2004, U.S. troops launched a full-scale siege in the Iraqi town of Fallujah. My guest, Dr. Richard Jaddick, was in charge of medical treatment during this month-long urban battle against an estimated 5,000 to 9,000 insurgents. Instead of setting up the medical aid stations safely behind the front lines, he set them up in the middle of the fighting to get to the wounded quickly. His battalion, the 1st Battalion 8th Marine Regiment, had 21 men killed in action. That fell below the 30% to 40% casualty rate predicted for the battle. Commander Jaddick received a Bronze Star with a Combat V for Valor. Just before deploying, Jaddick had been working as a surgeon with the Marines at Camp Lejeune. When he heard that there was a shortage of military doctors going to Iraq, he volunteered, even though he was 38, older than most battalion surgeons, and his wife was about to have a baby. After returning home from Iraq, he was the subject of a Newsweek cover story. He's written a memoir called On Call in Hell, A Doctor's Iraq War Story. Dr. Jaddick, welcome to Fresh Air. Would you describe what the American soldiers faced in the Battle of Fallujah in 2004?
Sure. Every American soldier, Marine, and sailor who went in was really looking at a well-dug-in defensive system of insurgents who had been there for quite some time. Fallujah was never really occupied or patrolled very seriously by the American forces before any of this, and then it became a hotbed of insurgency. So the insurgents had their way throughout the city to dig whatever defensive systems, perimeters, set up makeshift hospitals, that kind of thing, for a long time. So we were looking at a well-entrenched urban fight that I think really kind of, as you look at weapon systems, takes away some of the technical advantage that our military has.
Now, you basically set up aid stations in the heart of the Battle of Fallujah. You were working under enemy fire. Why was it important to you to set up aid stations in the battle as opposed to doing it more safely in the rear, which was typically what's done?
Well, when I began looking at the plan, and I really I looked at every time we went out on an operation or some sort of patrolling system where we had our troops somewhere, I always looked at it as to how was the best way for me to care for the Marines that were out there, and that's my job. So it made sense for me to really analyze this urban battlefield and figure out how can we get the Marines most efficiently to medical care. And what made sense to me and what has always made sense to me was not trying to bring the Marine to the medicine, but bring the medicine to the Marine. And when I went initially prior to the battle, we went on a recon. I went with the command element and we went out around the perimeter to draw fire. It was obvious to me that this was a long drive from there back to the surgical hospital to get any kind of real treatment. And once you got into the middle of the city, you never knew how long it was going to be from getting a Marine from the point of injury back to any kind of care. So my thought, and when I presented to the colonel, the thought was, let's get our people as far forward so that there's only a 5-minute difference between the time they're injured and the time they get some significant medical care.
So what kind of places did you set up your aid stations in?
Well, we set, really it was two aid stations. I set up a very full, robust aid station at the, at the forward edge of the battle area, or what we call the FEBA. We had an assembly point just behind the FEBA. I set up with the second physician, there's two physicians in a battalion, and he ran most of the corpsmen. I took six other corpsmen into downtown Fallujah at the government center, and in a little prayer room inside that government center, we set up our second aid station. And what that did to us was give us one aid station that would cover the whole southern end of the battlefield and one aid station that would cover the northern end. So it really was, you know, 5 minutes from point of injury to a physician or a significant provider with trauma experience.
What were the typical wounds that you saw in the Battle of Fallujah?
The typical wounds, because of the body armor that we all wore, were extremity wounds. We saw a lot of, arm, leg wounds, and some significant head wounds. The wounds, though, that we saw that were really concerning were anything that got in between the plates in the upper body armor, which didn't happen really too often. I had a couple of shots to the chest, and but the other one that was very life-threatening was there was a lot of wounds to the inner groin area that became the wound that was really the most concerning because all the vessels that are packed in there and the difficulty it is, you can't put a tourniquet around it. You have to really just put your hand in there and pack it. So those were the wounds we saw, and we learned very quickly how to deal successfully with the groin and kind of chest wounds.
Why were there so many groin injuries? Was there no body armor in that area of the body?
There is not. You know, it's a joint. It's very difficult to put any kind of armor in there. You know, you can armor it, and you could put a Marine in complete armor, but then he doesn't move around very well. So there's trade-offs. You need to armor as much as you can. However, you don't want to. You're giving a guy an extra 12 pounds of body armor, as well as a very large contingent of ammo and the gear he's going to need to be through this city and live for anywhere from 2 to 4 weeks. So adding more armor makes it difficult. I took it as our challenge was to figure out how to save those people who were shot in those areas. And I think, you know, we were very successful with that.
What was it like the first time you treated a severe groin injury before you figured out how to treat it?
I'll never forget. The first time was the day after the battle kicked off, and we had gone into the city. And once in the city, we got a phone. We got a call. I was in the ambulance, and we were taking one Marine out who had been shot in the chest. And actually, it was a Navy Corpsman, Force Recon kid. And we got a call to go into the middle of an ambush area. So we moved the ambulance down there, and that's when I saw my first groin injury, and it was Sergeant Lonnie Wells. And he came over, and it was relatively chaotic, but I did everything I could. I packed that wound. I tried to stop the bleeding, and I couldn't. I had six other wounded Marines, so triage became what I had to do, a very dirty word. Sorting out and moving on. And as I rode back in the ambulance, I played this over my mind a million times. What did I do or didn't do that could have changed this course of events for Sergeant Wells? And Sergeant Wells became a pivotal point where I realized that we were there pretty quickly. And I got to him before he lost all, you know, before he passed on us. But I didn't do the right things to save his life, and I wasn't sure why I wasn't able to pack that wound tighter or make the move to change the course of events. So when we got him out of there, I really thought about it for about an hour, because that's all the time I had before PFC Volpe came in with the same wound. He had the same wound. He was unconscious and pale as a ghost and in shock, and he came in, and I realized that I didn't pack tight enough on Sergeant Wells, and that I needed to put my hand in there and grab everything I can and just keep as much compression on these vessels. And that's what I did. We pushed some fluid, and the outcome was a lot different for PFC Volpe. After that, as I sat down and kind of reworked this thing, I knew that we had to be as close as we could, because these kids will bleed out in 5-10 minutes. And I also knew that we were going to need to really be aggressive in treating any kind of bleeding with tourniquets and compression and IV fluids.
How do you do triage in the middle of a battle?
You look at your wounds, you look at what's around you, and you assess. Really, my triage was who can I get to and save their life within the next 3 minutes by some sort of intervention? Who is anybody who's going to require more of my time than that? I don't know if I can spend that much time with them. And that's it. I mean, there's NATO and U.S. triage categories, but I really didn't use many of those. I used those who weren't going to die no matter what I did, and they were just wounded. Those who were going to die if I didn't do anything, and those who were going to take too much of my time that the others may pass away, because I spent too much time with them.
My guest is Dr. Richard Jaddick. His memoir is titled On Call in Hell, A Doctor's Iraq War Story. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. ¶¶ My guest is Dr. Richard Jaddick. He's written a memoir called On Call in Hell about being a doctor during the Battle of Fallujah in 2004. There were things that you learned to improvise in Fallujah, like warming IV fluids by taping them to people's bodies, because it would get cold sometimes, and the cold IV would be very bad.
Right.
So what are some other things that you learned to improvise with experience?
Everything we do out in the military seems to be improvisation. You've got a certain amount of gear, but there are other things that you can utilize. We improvise every day by trying to figure out where we're going to set up our aid station. Our aid station happened to be a perfect place with, you have to think about access to it. You have to think about putting stretchers in it and getting gear for it. We improvised when it got cold. We improvised with the fires. We had the engineers kind of open up some holes in the wall, and we built little fireplaces in the wall. And when we knew the casualties were coming, we always had embers burning in there, and then we'd stoke them up because it got very cold. It got to 25, 26 degrees after Thanksgiving. So when that happens, what you're going to wind up doing is bringing a patient in, taking their clothes off, and figuring out where their wounds are and trying to plug these holes, but you're going to make them hypothermic. So we had two fireplaces going in our second aid station that we would just kick up, and you would sweat in the room when those things were going. So it really did work. And innovation certainly wasn't my innovation. It was the corpsman's innovation. They would come up with things that transfers of patients into the ambulances, and how to use a loading dock was key, because we could move patients in and out faster when we had that set up. So we looked at everything out there as the opportunity to kind of improve your situation. One of the corpsmen came up with, we have to make latrines when we go out, or what we call in the Navy heads, and he came up with just a fantastic way to make heads out of sandbags, and it made it a lot more comfortable for anybody who had to use one.
Now, you're talking about how a lot of the injuries that you dealt with were bleeds, and what you did was often like pack the wound or apply a tourniquet. But some of the injuries you saw were brain injuries. How do you deal with those? Like a tourniquet isn't going to do the job.
you just, for the most part, for a brain injury, you're bandaging the head and sending them out and trying to stabilize them as best you can. And I look at, their airway, their circulation, whether they've got any other bleeds going on. But I will tell you that in triage, if on the battlefield somebody is displaying brain tissue or gray matter, then there's very little you can do for them, and for the most part, comfort is what you give them, and we did that on occasions.
Were you able to call in medevacs, and were they able to arrive quickly for the injuries like brain injuries, where there wasn't much that you could do?
There were no helo evacuations out of the city, and which is kind of where as the plan was being put together, and we thought about, hey, where are we going to have helicopter support? There really wasn't any way they were going to let helicopters fly over the city where they didn't know what kind of weapons and RPGs were going to be involved on all these rooftops. So because they were really trying to prevent a Black Hawk down, and I can't blame them for that, we on the ground had to be more innovative about our evacuation. So I evacuated, we did all self-evacuation. Everybody I had who was wounded and in the 1st Battalion, 8th Marines, went back to an ambulance exchange point, which was way back about a mile and a half from my forward aid station. But it was through, a lot of times it was through Indian country. So there were, and the roads weren't good. So it was, I wanted to make sure that my guys were very stable before they made that trip. And then once they got back there, we'd exchange them with an ambulance that would take them into the combat surgical hospitals, or the Bravo Surgical, which happened to be the surgical company that was taking care of us in Camp Fallujah.
Was it difficult for you to decide? I assume it was like your job to decide when when a Marine should be sent back into battle if the wound was manageable enough that they could return to battle. Are those hard decisions to make?
They are. It is my decision. It was never a decision I took lightly. And I will tell you that on one occasion, I had a Marine come in who had been shot through his helmet. And he just walked in with his helmet under his arm and said, "Doc, I really, my head's killing me." And we looked at his head, and he had taken a sniper round that grazed the top of his scalp. He had splayed it open, but it didn't go through the bone. So he was probably the luckiest man I'd ever seen. The decision that day was, you need to go home. At least take the next couple of days off and come rejoin the group after you get that thing washed out. So we sent him home. Unfortunately, most of the Marines wanted to go back very quickly, and I treated that same day a young Lance Corporal DeMarcus Brown, who was really just had a lip laceration, and one of the corpsmen sewed it up, and he wanted to get back out there. And so we let him go, and his wound was pretty minimal, and our job is really to maintain the fighting force. That's what we need. We need people who are putting rounds down range, and my job is really to make sure that that's happening and that people aren't just leaving. And I never had that with the 1st Battalion, 8th Marines. People did not want to leave, and DeMarcus Brown wanted to go back to his unit, so we sent him back out. Unfortunately, DeMarcus Brown came in the next day with a chest shot and didn't make it.
Sometimes the Marines who you saw were so mangled you couldn't tell who they were until reading their dog tags. And because some of these men were men who you'd known and already worked with, that must have been pretty upsetting.
Yeah, it's extremely upsetting. I think for me as an older person, it was something I really did compartmentalize and didn't deal with until I was gone. But I knew that the corpsmen who lived with these guys and knew them well, there was a moment on almost every Marine, because they came in very, even if they were okay, they were beaten up, they were bloody, and they were dirty. They were covered in mud, and if they came in and they weren't with us anymore, if they were not alive, then there would certainly be some very serious wounds that were going on, and nobody really would understand who the Marine was until we started to really look into finding the dog tags. And there was this, what I called a moment of realization, and it was sad to watch, because people didn't know, and all they knew was that they had a Marine there, and then they would realize that that Marine was somebody they might have lived over top of them, somebody that they had gone out and drank beers with back at Camp Lejeune. And it was always a difficult thing to deal with for these kids, as they would have to put them in body bags and we'd have to evacuate them out of there.
My guest is Dr. Richard Jaddick. His memoir is titled On Call in Hell, A Doctor's Iraq War Story. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Richard Jaddick. He's written a memoir called On Call in Hell about being a doctor during the Battle of Fallujah in 2004. In addition to treating Marines in the Battle of Fallujah, you treated some civilians. You also treated some insurgents. Why did you treat insurgents? And what do the rules of war have to say about treating the enemy?
Well, the rules are that you're supposed to treat everybody that's out there on the battlefield. First of all, and I, you know, I'll say that because of my Hippocratic Oath, the oath that I've taken to become a physician, I was going to treat everybody anyway. I didn't have a problem with that. I was able to come to terms with the fact that, you know, if they're insurgents, it's not my job to judge who lives and who dies. It's my job to put my skills to effectively treat and manage their wounds. Now, there were some bad men that came through my aid station that I treated, and the way I discussed it with my corpsmen who were having problems with it was, you know, these are guys who they stayed because they wanted to become martyrs. To become martyr, they have to die, and if we can keep them alive, then that takes away the only reason they were here. So it was a little reverse psychology, but in reality, our job was, on top of that, to provide a healthy patient to the intelligence people so they could talk to them and try and get some sort of information out of it so that in the future that we can save our own, you know, our Marines, our lives. And then there was always the fact that sometimes a poor guy came in, may have been caught up, may be an insurgent, and I just didn't know. And I wasn't there to make that determination. So I treated everybody very equally. I never had the situation where I had to make a choice between, do I treat a Marine or do I treat an insurgent? It was always at an appropriate time that I could treat either one equally.
What about the security aspects of the insurgents in the same aid station as the Marines were, and did you have to worry about security even though the insurgents were wounded?
Absolutely. No insurgent came into the aid station without having two Marines on them and having been completely strip searched. Even then, I had probably four or five known Iraqi insurgents that they had dug out of a house. And they came into us, and one was sitting on the ground, blindfolded, hands tied behind his back, and he bit into one of my corpsmen. So even then, safety, you always have to be on guard. And we always had a very well-trained force of Marines who would stand off and watch us treat the patients, because the last thing I wanted to do is have my corpsmen with weapons trying to do that and treat a patient, and then the insurgent can actually get a hold of a weapon. So we were very thorough in how we dealt with insurgents who came in, and always concerned paramount over everything was the security of ourselves, and the Marines did a very good job of that.
So when you were treating insurgents who knew that you were an American doctor with the Navy, did they look at you like they really would prefer to kill you, or did they look at you with gratitude for treating them?
There was never, and it was different with different people. The hardcore insurgents never looked at me with gratitude. They hated everything I stood for, everything I was about. But, you know, hate's a painful thing to carry around with you, so I tried very hard not to have that with me. I wanted to get rid of it, do what I had to do, and be proud of what I did, and not walk around with this significant hate that would eat me up inside. That's what these guys had. I mean, they had a burning hate. There were quite a few kind of lower-tier insurgents, guys who probably didn't think that we'd actually come through, who were paid to stay in town, not paid a lot of money, but more money than they've probably seen ever in their lives. And these were guys who did feel relief that they had been captured, relief that we were treating them, and hopefully when they go back and they're offered a couple hundred bucks to do the same thing again, they think about it and say, well, I don't know, it doesn't make sense. So that's why we worked hard at treating them all the same.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us, and wish you good luck. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. It's been great to be on the show.
Dr. Richard Jaddick's memoir is titled On Call in Hell, A Doctor's Iraq War Story. Jaddick received a Bronze Star with a Combat V for Valor for his work during the Battle of Fallujah. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Sherrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Minhivar. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Spellbound, The Surprising Origins and Astonishing Secrets of English Spelling by James Essinger. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. And from the Criterion Collection, presenting a 2-DVD special edition of The Third Man, starring Orson Welles, in stores now at criterion.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Oh, yeah, I'm the type of guy that likes to roam around.
On the next Fresh Air, Dion, a great singer who started in the doo-wop era with such hits as I Wonder Why, Run Around Sue, and The Wanderer. He brought his guitar to our studio to sing old songs and new songs. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for Fresh Air.